Welcome to Stronger and Safer, the podcast produced by Building Hope Today. The mission of Building Hope Today is to prevent and reduce childhood sexual abuse. The concept and goal behind the Stronger and Safer podcast is to support this mission by educating and equipping justice professionals and multidisciplinary teams with principles and practices needed to support victims and survivors and hold offenders accountable. In addition, the Stronger and Safer podcast will provide tools, resources, and support for those that do the courageous work of advocating for, caring for, and supporting healing for victims and survivors. Finally, the Stronger and Safer podcast will provide a space to give victims and survivors an opportunity to give voice to their experiences. The Stronger and Safer podcast will include a variety of approaches for meeting the needs of justice professionals, advocates, communities, and victim survivors. The podcasts are broken into four separate tracks. Track one, Voices of Victims. Track two, Self-Care for criminal justice professionals, law enforcement, and victim advocates. Track three, Lessons from the Field. And track four, On Guard, Protecting Our Children. This is the first Voices of Victims podcast. You can expect many interviews with victims of sexual abuse in the future. There is much to learn from their stories and experience. But before we hear from victims, we want to make sure that we hear from those charged with giving victims a voice and doing it safely. Our guest today is Anne Tierney. She has spent her career giving victims a voice, and it's our privilege today to enter into a conversation with her, to listen to her, and to learn from her. As the Building Hope Today team began to talk about what it would look like for survivors or victims to share their stories, we wanted to make absolutely sure that that process in itself did not cause further harm. This is why we decided to start this series off somebody who's done this work for many, many years and understands that there's a delicate balance between empowering a victim in their storytelling experience and causing further harm. We need to acknowledge and validate how lived experiences do affect victims' survivors' lives, even after the victimization has stopped, and in cases where the criminal justice system has intervened and the offender has been sentenced. Understanding the fear and the trauma which can be triggered by sharing one's story, experience, and journey can really help us do a better job of listening, as well as ascertaining the approaches that'll best guide our work and remain trauma-informed and victim or survivor-centered. It's also important that we acknowledge the importance of giving voice, but also that there are risks that can exist. By doing this, it helps us reduce the risk of causing further harm in the story experience sharing process. Recognizing that it can take a village to wrap around individuals to help them feel supported, heard, and safe during their experience telling can and should guide all of our processes. We are so incredibly fortunate today to have our very first guest, Anne Tierney, with us. Anne Tierney is a licensed professional counselor working with children and families affected by child sexual abuse. Anne was program coordinated for CARES, Child Advocacy Center, and is a CARES clinician, conducting forensic interviews and working as a family advocate. Anne is a trained instructor of the NICHD Forensic Interview Guidelines and provides training to law enforcement, prosecutors, and child protective service workers on interview guidelines. She works with the U.S. Army to provide training for military police and social workers responding to allegations of abuse. Anne served as a statewide chapter coordinator for the Idaho Network of Children's Advocacy Centers. She's helped multidisciplinary teams and child advocacy centers develop interagency protocols while providing training and peer review for MDTs working with victims of child abuse and their families. Anne holds a bachelor's in psychology from Carroll College and a master's in counseling in mental health from Idaho State University. So I could not be more grateful than I am today to have our guest today. Anne Tierney's experience is second to none, as we just heard a little bit about in your bio, Anne, and you've been working with victims of child abuse or grooming related victimization for a long time. And it's just such an honor to have you here with us today. So thank you so much for spending some time with us. And just want to give you an opportunity here to maybe share a little bit more with our colleagues and our listeners. Maybe a little bit more than what I shared in your bio.
You bet. Well, when I was first doing my internship for my mental health counseling degree, I was working at a child advocacy center. That's where I was doing my internship. And I had an incredible teacher and mentor, and I was able to really see the power of when a child came, when they were ready to disclose, when they were ready to process, and seeing them from day one, when they walked in the door so scared, for the forensic interview and the team meeting and all the things that were happening, to when they were finishing and graduating counseling. And I couldn't believe the difference that I saw and the weight that was lifted and the light in these little kid and teenagers, faces and their bodies, but also their parents, and their, whoever their caregiver was that was with them. And I'm telling you, I was just smitten from day one. I couldn't believe it. We joke about it as being like, you've been bitten by the CAC bug, or, you know, this kind of prevention work or child abuse bug. And it sounds crazy to people who don't work in this field, but when you see real healing, and I believe that that's possible, it really is so powerful. And so that was something that drew me to this field and has really kind of kept me here and kept me engaged in it, because it's an ever evolving field. We can always learn, and learn how to do better and to help people process their stories whenever they're ready. And everyone's time frame is different, as we know, but I've seen it happen, and it's very cool.
You know, and you and I have had some really rich conversations around this too. When we talk about victims or survivors having the opportunity to give voice to their stories or their experience, it isn't like all of a sudden at this point that you disclose what happened as a child or even as an adult, if it's a delayed disclosure, that exact moment is, you know, that there isn't more of a story to share later or different reasons to share your story later. So in your experience, you know, how important is giving victims or survivors an opportunity to have a voice and to share their experience, both from the standpoint of that initial disclosure all the way through, you know, we know many survivors who have chosen to continue to share their story, whether it be because they are wanting to make change overall in a policy or whether they just think sharing their story in a more public way is healing for them. So, you know, there's this huge kind of gamut from that initial disclosure all the way to when victims or survivors may want to share it down the road for other purposes. In your experience in working with victims and survivors, how important is it that that they have that opportunity to voice or share their stories in their time and in their space?
You know, I think about that a lot when we're going into a forensic interview and for like, it maybe in an instance we have hard evidence, whether that's pictures or videos or things like that, where we know something has happened. And you're still giving the child the opportunity to tell you what happened and inform you about what's going on. And I, you know, sometimes they're ready and sometimes they're not, but I think giving children the opportunity to tell what has happened is so invaluable. I remember watching the Stewards of Children training a long time ago. This is back when I was, you know, going through school, and Marilyn Vanderburr said, "No one ever asked me if I was being hurt. No one ever gave me the opportunity to say what was going on." And that stayed with me. And I think, you know, they may be ready, they may not be ready, but I want to give them the opportunity and have it be a safe place and be a safe person and have there be a safe time frame that you're not in a rush and pressing this, you know, this child or teenager. But that at the end of the day, whether they disclose or they don't disclose or whatever, but that you've given someone the space and the opportunity if they're ready. So I guess that's an answer to a part of your question. You know, but that's something that stayed with me for sure, is that no matter what happens, that we can create a space that's safe. And a lot of times kids who don't disclose the first kind of go round and we pause or break or whatever, a lot of times they come back and they'll say, "I just wasn't ready to tell you."
Yeah.
You know, we try to keep the interviewer consistent, and they'll just say, "I wasn't ready. Yeah. And there's so many good reasons why they weren't ready. You know, we think it's this wrestling of do they want to or not to. I mean, it's so complicated, as we know. It's safety. It's a loved one. Oftentimes it's, you know, they're concerned about being taken from their home or not having food or shelter. I mean, as you know, it's so complicated. And I think it's important to remind our team members who maybe are observing, who are getting just as frustrated as everybody else when, you know, we really need this disclosure, wanted this disclosure to keep a kid safe, especially like we said, when we have other corroborating evidence. And we just can't. We can't make someone be ready. And so that's why I think it's important that we're talking about this today, because we all have to take some time to take a step back and think about how do we cultivate a space, maybe over and over and over and over again, to have it be a safe place for people to share when and if they are ever ready.
Right. You know, and I think too, so much in these cases that you work so closely with and that we're working with Building Hope today. And that is that, you know, the people usually that are harming the children or the victims are people that they trust and people that, that they've built a relationship with, unhealthy, you know, but I mean, it's people that they trust. And for us as a system to come in and just expect that somebody that they've never met, I mean, these people work, these people who hurt kids work very hard to build that trust, and they're patient. They take a very long time to do that. And I think that we have to step back and realize it takes some patience to build that trust and rapport, especially when we're talking about children disclosing. So you've also worked, I know, and we're going to be meeting with one of the most incredible survivors we've ever met in our next episode. But I know that you've also talked with and met with adults who have chosen to share their story for different reasons or above and beyond, shall we say, kind of that criminal justice process. How important do you think it is to provide opportunities, you know, from a societal standpoint or from a criminal justice standpoint or an advocacy standpoint? How important is it to continue to provide opportunities for people who've been hurt, additional or continued maybe opportunity to share their story? How is that important?
That, you know, and professionally, we all as humans have this want and desire to really be normal, to fit in, and to not stick out in some weird or awkward or, you know, quote unquote bad way. And so what I've seen is that people have this desire to know that what they went through, or what they felt, or what they still feel, whether that's guilt or shame or blame, is not abnormal. And so this desire to be connected and to know that they're not alone and isolated, I mean, that's a universal feeling that we can all understand. And so when an adult wants to share their story, I find it to be so powerful. And in fact, you know, we leverage other people's stories to even work with, you know, kids and teenagers and say, this person felt this way too. And this person learned how to deal with their PTSD symptoms. And it's one of the best teaching tools. It's one of the best counseling tools, you know, that I have found, because when we feel connected to other people, we're not so isolated, and it gives us power to look a little deeper, power to explore things that we just didn't want to, or those, you know, some of those cognitive distortions or whatever you want to name it that keep kind of creeping back in and ruminating. And so I think no matter how old you are, there's power in your story, because chances are it will connect to someone else, and will help them feel not so alone.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we've also had some conversations around there's all kinds of reasons that a survivor may want to continue to share their story in different forums or in different spaces or places. What are some of those reasons that you think they might want to do that? I mean, I think sometimes, like, you hit the nail on the head. It's empowering, and abuse is the, so it strips people, children, human beings of their power. And, you know, so when I think about maybe what some of those reasons are, I think they all come back to what you just said about, I get to decide this. I'm empowered about this. Mm-hmm. Have you also seen the reasons that survivors want to share their stories come out in other ways? Yes. Need to help others, or what are some other examples you have?
Yeah, you bet. There is a young girl who's so courageous, and she really wanted to tell her story. And she is given the U.S. Army permission to use it in their forensic interview trainings. And she's talking about how she was treated by the MDT members. And there are some positive experiences. There are some very negative experiences, but really kind of talking about her story and how we can learn and do better when we are working with children. One of her most positive experiences came from, and she felt most supported by BACA, the biking group. And, you know, a lot of people wouldn't expect that, but for her, they were the people who believed her and supported her and lifted her up when in some ways our MDT members, you know, they didn't do their job in the way that we would hope we would want to, you know, for any kid. So I've seen that kind of advocacy, a way to share their story, to say, guys, we can do better, you know, and you know, in other ways, I have seen young people want to share their stories. So as suicide prevention, as a way to, you know, have a different connection and belonging other than, you know, drug using or alcohol abuse. So I've seen, you know, that use as well. And I've also seen people want to share their story to just set their record straight. You know, there may be a misconception about what happened or why it happened. And they're like, no, I want to reclaim this narrative and tell the world, you know, like, you know, I watched Elizabeth Smart speak, and I think it was really interesting just to hear what she said, you know, about her abuse and some of the things that maybe the media had portrayed or that, you know, she had supposedly felt or done. And she was like, this is my truth. This is my story. And so I think there's also a reclaiming of that. This may have been portrayed a certain way, but this is my story. And so I've seen it in lots of different ways, whether it's advocacy or lessons learned or how we can do better. And also a thank you. We have an amazing family that's local, and the mom was willing to help speak to our Idaho legislature and speak about her experience at the Child Advocacy Center to help the centers be recognized and in state law. And so I've seen lots of different reasons, but I think ultimately it's so powerful, and it has to be driven from the person, the victim, the survivor. It can't be driven from a parent or anyone else. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
It doesn't work well.
Right. You know, and I think too, you know, you're right to say thank you, or to say this is, you know, this has been an experience. I think that as many survivors that I've heard really want to say thank you. There's also been many that I've talked with or met with that have said this system was not victim centered. It was not trauma informed. It actually causes much or more harm to me than the actual offense itself and the behavior itself. And so, you know, some of the work that I've done, I've had many survivors say, I want to share my story. Maybe not so much about the abuse, but the response, so that we can learn from that and do better, you know, as you mentioned earlier. So I absolutely agree with you, which is why I think we have to do a better job listening and try to identify what is motivating somebody's desire to want to share their story, and how do we support them in the way that meets their needs versus meets ours, you know? And I know we're going to be really hoping to include survivor stories in this Building Hope Today podcast, but we want to do that in a way that, and I hate to say it this way, that doesn't sensationalize the harm. There are some people that are just really intrigued by abuse. And I think our survivors can be exploited by that. And so, part of the reason we're starting off our podcast having this discussion is so that we can be really clear about why it is that why victims share their stories and why we want to support them in that process and not just make it about hearing another story that some people might, gasp at or whatever. So that kind of brings me to this next question. And you are going to be, I'm sure, the very best person to ask this question to. Does time frame matter? Does it matter, when a victim or survivor chooses to share their story outside of for purposes of the investigation or, for disclosure? If a survivor chooses to share their story kind of beyond that, does time frame matter? I mean, is it something that somebody should do immediately? Is it something somebody should wait for? Is there a recipe for this? What does your expertise tell us? What does your expertise tell us?
Yes, I wish there was some magic recipe. I think that time frame is everything. Timing matters, and timing has to be dictated by the victim, by the survivor. And it just can't be done any other way. I haven't seen it work well, I guess, or work out. I've seen it damage relationships and cause, major, major chasms that I don't know if to this day are repaired. And so, you can't make someone want to tell their story or tell it in the way that you think it should be told. We don't get to narrate their life. And so it ultimately has to be the decision by the person who has experienced those experiences. And they're the ones that got to say what those experiences were like, the good, the bad, the ugly, the stuff that makes you comfortable, the stuff that makes you uncomfortable. I think some of the most powerful stories that I've heard from people speaking at conferences and things are talking about the ways that they love their offender so much and the ways that their offender made them feel so special and that it was their very best friend in the whole world and all these things that they would do together. Yeah. And that the abuse, it was bad, but the thought of losing this person was so much scarier. Yeah. And, is that what everybody wants to hear? Probably not. It's easier for us to just think of this person as a horrible, awful, person who did nothing but hurt this kid. The person sharing their story is saying they gave me confidence and self-esteem. Now, was there a serious crime being committed and lots of other problems, of course, and abuse, the abuse was real and very detrimental, but it doesn't take away from that other piece of the story that I think is just easier sometimes to gloss over because it is so uncomfortable because it's so complicated. And that's the thing about abuse that always astonishes me and amazes me and also intrigues me is how deeply complicated it is for every single person. There's so many layers. And so it has to be on their time frame.
Right. Well, and I think too, when a victim or survivor is really working through that whole, this person did love me, or I did love them, or they gave me things, or I don't feel like I was abused. And we hear that, or I don't feel like I was a victim. And when the world looks at them and says, you were, what's wrong with you? Now we're adding shame on top of already a very complex, complicated healing process for the victim. And so, that's a great example of why timing matters. And I think it also matters just from the standpoint of where is that victim support going to come from, or that survivor support going to come from, and how important that is. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, but,
one other piece to I just want to add another piece to timing, Lydia. I think that, you know, it would be so nice if we could just have this, you know, someone's abuse narrative story, you know, fit into this nice little box and it's neat and we can wrap it up. And the fact is that, you know, and I know, and we've seen this, that timing shifts. Sometimes it's time to talk about, you know, talk through a story and explore pieces. And sometimes that we have to push the pause button. Sometimes that's not a safe thing. It's not a healthy thing. Sometimes, like you were just alluding to, support's there, support's not there. Or, you know, someone's dealing with another physical illness, or they're pregnant or something else where it's just not, you know, timing isn't something that once it's started, it's always on. It's timing is every day. You know, it's going to be different. And there's times where it's good and it's healthy to explore and share, and times that when it's not. And really, truly, that again has to be victim centered and driven by them, so that we're not doing more harm than good by helping someone, you know, explore a situation, you know, their past victimization.
Right. And, you know, too, as you were talking about that, I was just mindful of a situation I worked with where a young victim disclosed her abuse. I think she was probably 8 or 9. And then much later, the offender was being released from prison, and I began to work with this family, and the mother was really upset because she said, "Where do we go wrong? This our daughter is now 17 and wants to revisit this and is wanting to talk about it again and wanting to share her story publicly. And, you know, we packed all this up and put it away. We got her great therapy. You know, this has not been an issue for all these years. And where did we go wrong?" And I began to think back to some of the other cases I'd worked on, and what I kind of came up with, and you can probably speak better to this than I, but, you know, when abuse and trauma happens, as you go through different developmental stages in your life, you kind of have to redefine what that means to you, and you understand it differently. So yeah, you can take an 8-year-old and do all the right things and get therapy and they seem to be doing amazing. And then they hit adolescence and you're thinking, what is going on here? And it's not that you have to unpack it all and you did a bad job when they were 8. It's just that they're now in a different developmental life stage. And then that same child, when they go off to college and start having college experiences there, then they might need to redefine it again. And then when they decide to get married, if they choose to, or be in a relationship, and they may have to disclose this to their partner or their spouse, then they have to redefine it again. And then they have kids, and then it's a whole new redefinition. But does that make some sense, that timing is there based on development?
Absolutely. It makes perfect sense. And I mean, you can't explore all the things that may come up to an 8-year-old because it's not appropriate, right? But I do think it's a really important message, whether, you know, you're working with someone through the judicial process or as a victim advocate at the police station or at a CAC or a counselor, whoever, but that it's okay for this to, you know, to be an ongoing process of where, you know, you're going to think about this. There's going to be different things that might come up for you. And so what do we do? Like building a plan around that, because to expect that you're going to process this all and you're going to be all great and done and finished when you're 8. We know as professionals that that's not realistic, but families don't know that. That's not something that they're told. And so I think as a real service to families and victims, that letting them know again that it's normal for these thoughts and feelings to come up as they continue to grow and develop and go through different life milestones, but also to let their family know, and that it's not a bad thing to need. We called it like a counseling tune-up. So if you know, when you get to junior high, if you're having a hard time, you can come back. That doesn't mean that anything's wrong, but that we'll explore those coping skills that we taught, you know, that we went through, and we'll talk about different ones that maybe are more helpful, because people just need, sometimes we need to tune up because life happens and it gets hard. But for that to be normalized, and it's not that you failed or that you've backslid and you haven't you know, made progress or something like that. It's just, that's not accurate. It's just, as we grow and change, our thoughts and feelings continue to grow and change, or come up in a different way.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I think too, that we have an opportunity for those of us that do this work to really be aware of how detrimental it can be to do this work in silos. And so, you know, we may tell a caregiver who's helping this 8-year-old or 14-year-old, you know, this may change again in 3 or 4 years. You may need some support, or we may give them the nice little brochure that we all like to create. But when people have kind of gone through such a difficult emotional experience, especially as a family, the last thing they're really caring about is what they're hearing. You know, it's like that teacher on the Peanuts, right? Wah, 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 wah. Yeah. And they're probably not going to be looking at that brochure. Yeah. It might stick in a folder somewhere, or it might just go in the garbage because they just want to be done with it now. So, you know, I think it's a good conversation for those of us that do this work. How do we create that really warm handoff and without harassing people, making sure that there is, you know, is it okay if somebody checks in on you in a year or 2 years? Mm-hmm. And how do we follow up with that? And how do we really demand support to be able to meet that advocacy need? Because I think that we fall pretty short there when we think about long-term support.
And I think this is probably a good place for us to wrap up this first of two segments that we're going to have with you, Anne. And we're just so grateful that you have spent some time with us today. We're really looking forward to part two of this podcast, Stronger, Safer, Voices of Victims, where we are really going to look at, you know, your perspective on what is it mean to be trauma-informed and victim-centered? And what does that mean, especially when you're helping victims tell their story or share their experiences? You have been listening to Stronger, Safer, the podcast series of Building Hope Today, Voices of Victims. Remember, our goal is to give voice to victims and survivors and those that work tirelessly to support victims and survivors. Our goal is also to support those that work every single day to stop and prevent victimization and child abuse. Your voice matters, and our podcast must include you. If you have a question about something that you heard today, or an idea for a future episode, or if you have an idea for a guest that you'd like to suggest, or would like to be a guest yourself, please contact us at info@buildinghopetoday.org. We would love to hear from you. Remember, no matter who you are, survivor, justice system professional, adult advocate, child advocate, mental health provider, teacher, parent, or community member, you make a difference. You matter. And as Edward Hale once said, I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something I can do. You make a difference, even if it's for just one.